Hello and welcome. You're listening to Speaking of Urology, the official podcast for Urology Times. As always, our commitment is to deliver urologists and allied health professionals timely and informative insights from leaders in the specialty. Our exclusive interviews bring expert analysis, practice advice, and policy perspectives to help our listeners practice more efficiently. I'm your host and assistant editor, Janelle Hart. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Amy D. Dauberfull about the presentation Feasibility and Efficacy of Transvaginal Onobotulinum Toxin A Chemodenervation of the Trigome for the Third-Line Treatment of Refractory Overactive Bladder, which was given at the Society of Urodynamics, Female Pelvic Medicine, and Urogenital Reconstruction Winter Meeting. Dauberfull is urologist at Stanford Hospitals and Clinics and an assistant professor of urology at the Stanford University School of Medicine in California. So if you could start by summarizing the main points of the presentation you gave at SUFU.
I would be happy to. Let me just briefly outline the study. This originally began funded by the SUFU Foundation's study of chemodenervation through the SUFU Foundation. And it was we'd planned a double-blind placebo-controlled trial of transvaginal botulinum toxin A for refractory overactive bladder. Our original proposal had two aims. Our first aim was to actually complete a cadaver study, which we've subsequently published in Investigative and Clinical Urology around 2019. You'll have to double check that year. But essentially with that study, we looked at eight cadavers and performed transvaginal injection of a dilute India ink. And this was as a proof of feasibility before actually trying this technique in humans. This was a study we did in fresh cadavers. We had a laparoscope that was placed into the dome of the bladder and then a end fire needle guide ultrasound, the type of ultrasound you would normally use for truss prostate biopsy. We used that placed into the vagina to first localize and image the bladder of these cadavers, and then identify several of the landmarks and correlate some of the bladder anatomy via the ultrasound with the palpable anatomy of the bladder. Long story short, you can definitely read our paper we published, but from this technique, we found that we could accurately target injections of the detrusor layer via the vaginal route, and actually we performed histology on these tissues using different colors of India ink. We injected different areas, and then also assessed surgeon accuracy with each of these. And we did find that trigone injections were the most accurate of the different type of injections we could make. So from this, just demonstrating that this technique is possible in cadavers, we then began our human study, which was a double-blind placebo-controlled study, was the way it was initially designed. This is just before the COVID pandemic started, but we had some difficulty recruiting patients to something that hadn't been done in humans before. And so then sought an approval. We had an approval to make this an open label trial where all patients who have refractory overactive bladder, these would be women, adult women with no, who met our inclusion exclusion criteria, would be eligible for the transvaginal botulinum toxin, 100 units of Botox injection. Ultimately, we found the best way to do this was actually with ultrasound confirmation. So all patients had a vaginal ultrasound. That was just to confirm the anatomy and confirm the anterior vaginal wall thickness at the trigone. The ultrasound was then removed. Then a half speculum was placed, and under direct visualization of the trigone and the anterior vaginal wall, the botulinum toxin was injected. The botulinum toxin was reconstituted with 3.5 milliliters of saline and then injected using a very fine needle, typically a 25 gauge needle. And it was very well tolerated during the procedure. Majority of procedure pain scores, I don't have the mean off the top of my head, but were around 1 to 2 on the 0 to 10 numerical rating scale. So that part was feasible. We then did immediately after that a vaginal ultrasound to confirm that we had injected, and you could see a characteristic increase in the thickness of the intervaginal wall where the injection was done. We then assessed outcomes. There was pre-specified outcomes at 6 weeks and also 12 weeks with our primary outcome was a treatment benefit scale. And we did find more than 50% of subjects were improved at these intervals, the 6 and 12 weeks. So based on this, we saw changes in several of our secondary outcomes. They were significant at 6 weeks. They were not all significant compared to baseline at 12 weeks. This is just one consideration about this study that should be taken into account in designing future studies. So I guess some of our main points with this talk is that this technique is feasible, it's very well tolerated, and there's not much of a complication rate. So it appears to be very safe, but still it's not FDA approved. For anyone who wants to continue this, we'll need more research.
And then kind of stemming from those findings, how will they impact the way that you treat this population of patients in the future?
So overactive bladder and also interstitial cystitis bladder pain syndrome, both of these problems are big portions of my practice, not only from a clinical care standpoint, but also from a basic science and translational research standpoint. These are patients I see every day, almost in the multitudes. But the way I think at this early stage, this is very early, this is an investigative route of delivery. So we're not to the point that we're ready to recommend a widespread adoption of this technique for overactive bladder. There's certainly considerations related to the methods of our study. This was open label, so all of the patients knew that they were getting a treatment. So to study this further, particularly for overactive bladder, a next step would include considerations related to your study design, just to minimize the effect of a placebo, some sort of bias from them knowing that they had gotten a treatment. Other considerations that could also be given for this in the future could be related to the dose of botulinum toxin that's used. We used 100 units. There potentially could be effects of even lower doses. So that's something else that could be explored. And also concentration. So all of these were diluted in 3.5 milliliters of saline. Part of that was out of a need to be sure that the patient was able to feel that the needle was where it needed to be and that the patient could really feel that they were getting the treatment. There's a concept I discuss quite a bit with a lot of collaborators, and this concept of an air ball. If the patient doesn't feel the needle going into the detrusor, they may not actually be getting the treatment through this route. So the 3.5 milliliters during approximately maybe the first milliliter of that injection, I'll ask the patient, do you feel something? And they'll describe something. It will usually be a gentle cramp, a suprapubic cramp during the injection. And then I'll continue the injection. Then eventually that will subside, usually between a minute to 5 minutes after the injection. So back to your question, how will this impact the way I treat this population of patients? Some of the members of the original SUFU study we've been able to actually seek approval for, and we were granted through my institution a special CPT code specifically for this technique. So I am able to offer this to my patients with overactive bladder currently. And there are patients who are continuing to get this and we're able to get some of this covered by insurance. But still, as far as widespread adoption, it's still too early. And then other considerations about population, I have some interest in how this may also play a role in interstitial cystitis, bladder pain syndrome.
And then I was curious as to what other innovations in the OAB space are currently on the horizon.
That is an excellent question. And I'm sure any of our members, SUFU or the ICS or whoever has been in this space for a while can probably see just from the number of vendors that are present to this type of meeting. There are new pharmacotherapies, the Vibrecon that is coming online, some of your beta 3 agonists. It seems like a lot of the innovation is coming in the form of third line treatments for overactive bladder. That seems to be an area of development, including some of the peripheral neuromodulation type techniques that are stemming off of some of the treatments related to PTNS, but things that are some of the implanted nerve stimulators. Also, some of the other innovations are the now the MRI compatible sacral neuromodulation type techniques and also the rechargeable generators for those sacral neuromodulation type techniques. But this could potentially be among those innovations.
And the last question I have for you today is whether there's anything else you feel the audience should know about this particular topic or this study.
So related to the transvaginal botulinum toxin, I think where a lot of the research question, at least for me, is at this point is what is actually the mechanism that this may be modulating, shall we say, modulating overactive bladder. I think there's increasing evidence that the trigone does play an important role in overactive bladder and also in interstitial cystitis bladder pain syndrome. We have an opinion paper recently published in the International Urogynecology Journal that you're definitely welcome to read if you'd like to read more just about the role of the trigone. It's particularly in ICBPS, but where this might play as a future role as a therapeutic target for this condition. We have a new trial that has recently, it's just our own funded trial, looking at interstitial cystitis, bladder pain syndrome, using a similar technique that's still in its early phase, but hopefully we'll be presenting this at SUFU maybe in another year or two. So many things in the pipeline.
Be sure to subscribe to Speaking of Urology on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps. You can get the latest in urology news, practice management advice, and health policy updates by visiting www.urologytimes.com. Thank you for listening.